This is The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. As Steve reported, the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals has stayed Scott Panetti's execution. Word came this afternoon, mere hours before he was to be put to death by lethal injection in Huntsville. Scott Panetti's attorneys say the 56-year-old Fredericksburg man is a paranoid schizophrenic and is ineligible for the death penalty. But what are the rights of the mentally ill when it comes to capital punishment? Is the Texas court, the American justice system, and the mental health system failing Panetti and people like Panetti? What is next for Panetti's case? We ask you to call in with your questions and comments. Numbers 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Do you think that Scott Panetti should be spared execution because he is mentally ill? You could also email us at thesource@tpr.org and tweet us at @tprsource. Our guest this half hour is Paul Ginfrido. He is the CEO and Mental Health America, a community-based network advocating for changes to wellness and mental health policy, and Amy Dillard, professor of law at the University of Baltimore. Welcome to The Source, both of y'all.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So, Paul, can you get us up to speed on, like, what did Scott do? Why is he on death row?
Well, he was convicted of a murder, and so he's been on death row for quite a while at this point. I'm not sure there's much else to say about that. I mean, that's sort of what happens often to people in Texas.
Sure. He murdered his in-laws, his mother-in-law and father-in-law, in front of his wife, and it's been described as he was said that the devil told him to do it, and his alter ego, Sarge, committed the crime, and that his conviction and his incarceration and his execution is all the work of the devil, that he is part of a satanic effort to keep him from preaching the gospel. So Amy Dillard, professor of law at the University of Baltimore, does that mean that he's too insane to be executed?
Well, there's no doubt that Scott Panetti suffers a very severe mental illness, diagnosed as far back as 1978, described as being floridly schizophrenic, meaning active delusions, active hallucinations, active psychotic episodes, the kind of things that aren't quieted very much by medication. The court decided in a case called Panetti versus Quarterman, which is actually Scott's case that went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, that capital defendants have to be competent to be executed, meaning that they have to understand why they're being executed. And the court, in reviewing Scott's case, thought that he had not been given a full and fair hearing on whether he was competent to be executed, and reversed his case back in 2007, and it went back to Texas to decide whether he was competent to be executed. The Texas courts, in particular, the district court in Texas and the Fifth Circuit, decided that he was competent to be executed. It seems that now these are a slightly different issue that the attorneys have brought before the court that the Fifth Circuit's taken some note of now.
Right. They are saying that they need an outside competency judgment on his state of mind. I believe that is.
Yeah, that's one of it. Scott hasn't had a competency evaluation in 7 years. I think people who interact with him routinely have no doubt that he's still floridly mentally ill. But competency gets at a bit more than that, sort of a cognitive understanding and then a rational appreciation as well. It seems now, though, that one of the new wrinkle to the issue is whether or not the fact of his severe mental illness should be a bar to his execution, much like the court has said being a juvenile is a bar to execution, or being mentally retarded, to use the court's term, is a bar to execution. Is severe mental illness, suffering a severe mental illness, also a categorical bar to execution?
Right. So being severely mental ill, like Scott or others who are on death row, he's not the only one there who has been diagnosed as a schizophrenic and has committed murder and is on and is awaiting execution. Is that something that should be considered in whether or not he actually is executed? So Paul at Mental Health America, I mean, where do you guys weigh in on this?
Well, I mean, I think that the first place would be that we need to recognize that mental illnesses can be severe and they can be persistent and they can, you know, really become debilitating and lead to all kinds of tragic outcomes. And but we also should recognize that as a matter of course, people with mental illnesses are more likely to be convicted of crimes and thrown in jail for a whole variety of reasons. And I think where we come down on this is that the wrong place to be dealing with mental illnesses is in the court system. It's in the criminal justice system, in the jails. The right place to be doing that would be in treatment facilities and treatment programs. One of the things that we need to keep in mind is that when people have been diagnosed with schizophrenia, live with schizophrenia, or any other serious mental illness for a long time, if we can't look back and make the case that we did all we could do to mitigate the effects of that disease, just as we do for all other kinds of chronic conditions like cancer, heart disease, anything else, and if we've treated this one differently and said in this instance our norm is to move people into the criminal justice system and to deal with stage four mental illness within the jails and not within healthcare facilities and not with medical and health related services, then we put ourselves into binds like this. Whether somebody who is, you know, convicted of a murder ought to be pay a price for that is, in my mind, a different question. And in that sense, the mental illness becomes irrelevant. Now, in this case, obviously, there's relevance to the mental illness in terms of what we know and what we have heard, and certainly that needs to be taken into account. But in a way, mental illness in and of itself is not necessarily the excusing factor or necessarily ought to be an excusing factor for people, you know, paying a price or having a penalty. Whether or not the death penalty should be imposed in this particular case, though, is a very different question. And I think that most rational people would feel as if it's probably not appropriate here.
How confident are we that Scott Panetti is actually severely mentally ill, paranoid schizophrenic, Paul?
Well, you have to listen to the clinicians, I suppose, with that, right? I mean, you can listen to the lawyers, you can listen to the judges, you can listen to the politicians, and they can tell you whether they think he is. You can listen to advocates like me, I can tell you whether I think he is. But the people who know are him and his clinicians. I mean, I'm not competent to diagnose cancer, and I'm, you know, and non-clinicians aren't competent to diagnose mental illness either. And so the idea that we think that everybody is, and we think we all should be able to look at a case like this and say, okay, well, you know, he shouldn't have done that. You know, he had control over that. He knew what he was doing. He, you know, none of us who are outside of that system sort of know the answers to that question. So in my view, you rely on the clinicians, and you let them tell you how sick a person is and whether or not they are sick, just like you rely on the clinicians to diagnose cancer or heart disease and don't try to do it yourself at home.
Sure, and Scott did have a 30-year history of mental illness. He had been diagnosed at Brooke Army Medical Center when he was in the Air Force, and many episodes and breakdowns along the way. We're going to continue this conversation. We're going to continue this conversation as we take a quick break. We invite callers to, what do you think about Scott Panetti and whether or not he should be executed? The number is 210-614-8980. This is The Source. Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. Of the 38 states that allow capital punishment, 15 have exemptions for those with intellectual disabilities, but no such exemptions exist for those who are mentally ill. And mentally ill criminals do not have the same protection from capital punishment as those who are juveniles. Also, the question before us is, should Scott Panetti, a man who was up in Fredericksburg, Texas, who committed a double homicide, if he should be executed? The state of Texas is trying to do so. Today, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals said it granted a stay, so there could be another look at his mental health. There hasn't been an examination for him for 7 years. And on Monday, the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles voted unanimously not to delay Panetti's execution, saying that he should be put to death. So the number is 210-614-8980 if you want to join the conversation. Amy Dillard, professor of law at the University of Baltimore, why hasn't this been answered before? It seemed like a basic question.
Well, let me clarify a couple of things. That, you know, mental illness is relevant in criminal prosecutions in a couple of ways. One, it might be relevant to whether someone's guilty or not, meaning they don't know the difference between right and wrong. Scott didn't raise that insanity defense at his trial.
But he was representing himself. That's another big wrinkle in this case.
So it wasn't raised in the way that it might be.
But why would we allow someone to represent himself, who is clearly insane, in his own trial, dressed in a Tom Mix cowboy outfit, and call up Jesus Christ and John F. Kennedy to the witness stand? How was that an actual defense for a capital murder?
Yeah, it's hard to believe now, and it's hard to believe in light of the Supreme Court's decision in 2008 in a case called Indiana versus Edwards, where the court said that defendants who are competent to stand trial, but only marginally competent, still must have counsel to represent them. They don't have a right to represent themselves. You know, if this case were in trial court today, it is very difficult to understand how Scott Panetti was, A, found competent to stand trial, and B, even if he had been found competent to stand trial, how on earth he could have been competent to represent himself. But, you know, this is an evolving area of the law. We have evolved a lot in the last dozen years in terms of how we view mental illness and mental incapacity and capital punishment. You know, it's been in the last 12 years that the court has said the categorical bar to executing mentally retarded defendants, categorical bar to executing juveniles. But that's fairly new law, and law that wasn't in effect when Scott was on trial wearing his purple suit, representing himself and subpoenaing Jesus. When we look back at that, it seems appalling. I suppose at the time it appalled many people, but it didn't appall the court, the courts that were reviewing that case as it was coming up through the channels at that time. You know, in many ways, his appeal at this point, or his claim at this point, is that the law has evolved so much in how we view those who are operate with a mental deficit, or by youth or otherwise, or who have a mental illness, that his severe mental illness should be a categorical bar to his execution and the execution of others who fall into that same category.
So the state of Texas is saying that they understand that he is mentally ill, but the question is he so mentally ill that he shouldn't be executed, Amy? Is that it?
Well, there are two questions really that are out there. One is, you know, how competent must a prisoner be before he can be executed? And the court's very clearly said that, you know, prisoners, that capital defendants, capital prisoners, have to understand why they're being executed. Scott has raised that claim, but through his lawyers, of course, that he's not competent to be executed. But now I think the court's going to undertake a slightly more nuanced question, which is, from the fact of his severe mental illness, is he the kind of person, as Paul said earlier, you know, who deserves a different level of protection from the larger community, in the same way that mentally retarded defendants and juveniles deserve that higher degree of protection, the court says, from execution, than other members of the community? Does he fit into that kind of category of people who, you know, we should take better care of?
So even if he is found to be mentally competent today, the question is, I mean, is it a question even, what was his state of mind when he committed the crime? Mentally ill people can be perfectly normal for weeks or years and suddenly have a psychotic break and commit crimes like this, Paul. So should the people be held accountable if they are, you know, reasonably sane today, but they had a psychotic break and committed a crime?
Well, I mean, the state of Texas should be held accountable. You know, the first level here is that Texas is historically one of the states that's done the poorest job of investing in mental health services for its citizens. And so, you know, it needs to bear some responsibility for that. And the truth of the matter is that you're right. You know, you could have what I would call a relapsing, remitting disease here with schizophrenia. I have a family member, my son, who has schizophrenia, and, you know, not every moment of every day is the same. You know, the symptoms are better on some days and worse on other days, just as they are when people have cancer, heart disease, or other kinds of chronic conditions. So the idea that now you would say, well, suppose the symptoms were remitting on the day of the crime, but the relapse had occurred on the day of the trial. What do we do then? And vice versa. Suppose the symptoms were in full remission at the trial, but the relapse period occurred at the time of the crime. Those are interesting questions that, you know, get us into places where we really need to have clinicians help us make those decisions. But in this case, it doesn't really look like there was any doubt about the fact that the symptoms were full blown on the day of the crime and the days of the trial.
Okay, I'm going to take a caller. Our phone lines are open. The number is 210-614-8980. Al has called in. Al, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Well, thank you very much. I'll try to make this brief. And it's basically in the form of a comment, but open to question by your panelists. And it's this. I see something as fundamental here, something that transcends the whole discussion, and that is language. You have the language of the behavioral sciences, psychiatrists, psychologists, clinicians, et cetera, and then you have the language of the legal system, which in the end comes down to, you know, distinctions that, such as sane, insane, and either or. And I think that where these two languages intersect is the problem here. On one side, on the legal side, you know, you want something with certitude. On the behavioral side, psychiatrists, etc., they understand the difficulty involved, really, in diagnosing anyone, even under the best of circumstances, without, you know, legal mitigation. It's a very, very difficult thing. And that's what I would offer here if your panelists want to discuss that. It's simply two different languages. Thank you very much. I'll take it off the air.
All right. Thanks for your call, Al. Appreciate that. So, Amy, is Al, yeah, does he have a point there?
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I teach this to my students when I teach both insanity and competency, and I've talked to many psychologists and psychiatrists, forensic psychologists, who do the work. You know, the area of competency, whether it's competency to stand trial or competency to be executed, is wholly designed by the legal system. Meaning, if you had a patient just being treated for mental illness in a hospital or an outpatient setting, the clinicians wouldn't treat to restore someone to competency to stand trial or to restore someone to be executed. That's just not the work of doctors. That is the work that the law asks doctors to do, and to then advise us and judges about how to make these very black and white legal decisions. But he's flat right that there is loggerheads in many ways between the clinical community trying to treat patients and judges who need crisp answers to questions of law.
Well, what about the ethicist? I mean, here we are. We have a system that is aiming to execute a man who is clearly insane, doesn't understand his actions, and people are wondering, what will this serve, Paul?
Yeah. Well, that's right. I don't know that will serve any useful end. Although maybe it will make people, I hate to be so hard on Texas. I love Texas, lived there for 4 years. But again, the truth of the matter is, does this make people forget the fact that Texas just hasn't done a very good job for people like that, you know, between 1977 and 92, and that mm-hmm. the same thing, the new folks who are developing signs and symptoms of schizophrenia, you know, are we doing enough for them, or has anything changed, really, in the state that's going to mitigate the effects of what is a horrible and serious disease? And I think the caller was right. I agree completely with that, too, about the idea of the language. I mean, when somebody has a serious mental illness, they have a serious mental illness every day. Whether or not the legal system would define them as competent on that day or not competent on that day. They still have the serious mental illness, and when they have it and when it's a factor, of course, it should be taken into consideration. That doesn't mean people should not be penalized for harm they do. Nobody's saying that, but it does have something to do with what those penalties are, and I think that's the key point here.
Okay, another caller, John. John, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you, and I don't mean to use this term in a derogative way, but this is clearly an individual who is in prison because there's nowhere else to place him, and this is a failure of some of the reforms of the late 70s through the 80s of closing down asylums and mental health institutions exactly for people like this who are a danger to themselves and other people, and they're unpredictable, and there's no way they could ever be reformed in prison because the mental illness takes care of any rehabilitation. So it's time that we need to relook this and bring back a system where we can have places for individuals like this, where they get the help they need, where they can be contained so that they're not a danger to anyone else, but at the same time, they're not facing these kind of things like execution or the brutality of having mental ill people in prison.
Okay, John, thank you for your call. And so, Paul, bring back the asylums. Is that an option?
Okay. That's what we've done. I mean, I hate to be cavalier about that, but that's what we've done. We have the same system in place today that we had then. We just call the asylums jails and prisons. And I think people need to understand that thousands of people who are in our jails and prisons in every community, the largest mental health facilities in the nation right now are county jails. And so we still have that system in place, and I agree with the caller that it's a failure, that system is a failure. So just as the system was with those large custodial institutions, just as that system was a failure, this one is too because it's the same system. Where I hope we would agree is that we need to throw them both out, get people out of jail, and get them into treatment. Everybody believes who looks at this that we need to get people into treatment who need treatment. That will make them safer, society safer, and everybody healthier. So let's just focus in on that.
Okay. Amy, let me ask you real quickly about the future of this case. The Supreme Court in 2000 basically said Texas cannot execute Scott. So if it gets back to the court, will they have the same sort of reaction? It's a different court.
It's hard to know and hard to predict. I had the pleasure of talking to one of Scott's lawyers when we were waiting to see if the Supreme Court was going to take his appeal up earlier in the fall, and they were a little shocked that it wasn't taken up at that point. You know, the fact that the Fifth Circuit has put the brakes on this and has said that we need to give a full consideration to these complex legal questions is bound to be a good sign. The fact that the court recognizes they are complex legal questions is good, and maybe the Fifth Circuit will find the right remedy in this case without it having to go back.
All right,
to the Supreme Court.
Paul Ginfrido at the CEO of Mental Health America and Amy Dillard at University of Baltimore. Thank you. This is The Source on KSTX.